Okay, I'm going to speak about Open Source Business 101 for Hackers, and as I've been listening through everybody else's presentations today, I've realized that specifically what this talk is about, it's about building businesses around open source projects specifically, not necessarily service businesses around entire functional areas, that sort of thing, but as I'm listening to everybody else, I'm kind of realizing, wow, I had this focus that I didn't know I had. I'll get to a little bit more of that later, but first I figured it'd be useful to tell everybody who I am. I've not been to Australia before, this is my first time. I'm from sourceforge.net, and I work there as the director of community, and what that means is I'm kind of like a double agent, because anybody who works in like a community management role or a double, or sort of like a director of community role ends up being a bit of a arbiter of arguments, usually. But what I like to think of myself as is kind of a corporate listening device. It's my job on behalf of the company to listen to what the company needs, to listen to what the developers need in the community, to listen to what our consumers need, people who come to SourceForge to download open source tech, and sort of the community at large to figure out where things are moving, what people are doing, what's important to people, and that sort of stuff. And to a lesser extent, I have to listen to our advertisers because, you know, everybody needs to get paid, and that's how we get paid. But ultimately, what I try to do is I try to make it so that everybody, all these people, the company and the consumers and the developers and everybody, don't kill each other and instead kind of sort of maybe even like each other or profit off each other. So that's what I do. So everything I say, take with that sort of context that sort of I sit on this fence between two worlds, this sort of corporate advertising media world and this open source world, specifically with SourceForge, a world where it's kind of people doing tech in their garages and starting projects that are small and things like that. So that's how to get in touch with me. I'll put that up again later. But I wanted to make it real clear that I'm not a business person. My background, I used to be engineering manager at SourceForge, and before that I did architecture and engineering and that sort of stuff. And a lot of services, I did I delivered services on behalf of SourceForge and that sort of thing. This is definitely an outsider's view of business. So if you happen to know anything about business in this room, you probably are going to laugh at me at like certain points throughout the next 40 minutes because I don't really know what I'm talking about with business, but it's really the geek's perspective on this business world that I found myself put in. So the first thing I want to talk about is, if I'm a hacker, why do I need to care about business? Like, why does it matter? Why does it make any difference to me? Software should be free, etc. Why do I need to care? The second one is just a couple of questions I want to ask, like everybody raise their hands, to figure out sort of where your mind is on a lot of pivotal issues that relate to business and open source together. The third is making money, or how I learned to stop worrying and love the money. And the fourth was sort of an exploration of businessy concepts that I've run into that apply in a really uncanny way to open source in general. So moving on to why should I care? The first reason is because, well, like everybody needs money. And I think that specifically open source provides a lot of opportunities to make money for a variety of purposes. But first I want to bring your attention to this quote. The dot-com bubble crash wiped out $5 trillion market value of technology companies from 2000 to 2002. This was someone who did an analysis in 2006 with the Los Angeles Times. And basically they're talking about how much money was lost when tech companies all exploded then. And the analysts were saying the same thing. They were saying that, you know, it lower stock values dampened IT spending, so people started spending less money on IT solutions. At the same time, in the exact same period, the number of downloads on SourceForge went up quite a bit, you know? So what I'm trying to demonstrate with this is that when the world is kind of hurting financially, open source tends to do really, really well, you know? And that's when our company had sort of, you know, sorry, that's when we had our largest growth, was when the economy was really doing shit. So this next quote is from someone just right now who's saying IT spending will decline about 3% in 2009. And this is the same graph from now, right? Showing just 2007 to 2008, it's even more dramatic. People are consuming open source at a much faster rate now. And especially you see the tail on the end where the economy really starts to become like crap. Except December, because people don't, I don't know why, but people don't download open source in December. Maybe it's the holiday, something like that. You find, like, if you study our numbers too much, you go absolutely crazy because there's nothing consistent ever that ever happens. But the general trend tends to be major up when everybody else is kind of down. So the hypothesis is that if you graph awesomeness over time, then open source kind of goes up when the world goes down, right? So that's one reason why geeks should care about open source, because if you're an open source programmer, you have a good opportunity right now. The second is because, and this is something that I know people who really pay attention are probably laughing at me a bit, but acquisitions have happened like a lot over the past, and they're starting to get increasing in value. You know, MySQL $1 billion, you know, like that's not even a real number. And, you know, so there's real money to be made in these acquisitions. From the 451 group, Matthew said that he expects to see an increase in M&A activity in the first half of next year. So he gives a lot of reasons for that. There are opposing views, but it's also something you need to think about, is that there was this big, like, huge gold rush last year, right as the economy started ramping down, of all these acquisitions happening and all these geeks making tons and tons and tons of money on open source. So the next thing is that you can build a business off of open source these days. It's kind of tough because you need, you know, enough money to get it started. You need a big enough problem that you're solving that people will care. And I've seen a lot of people try to build big businesses around open source that no one really cares what problem they're solving. And you also need a sufficient audience. So these are kind of the three factors that when I look at building a business out of open source that you kind of need. You need, you know, the resources, you need the problem, and you need the people. But that's not to say, I'm getting around to the point, and the point is, it's not to say you still can't make a decent living off of something that isn't like this big, huge, global, I'm gonna go sell enterprise databases or I'm gonna go sell operating systems. You know, you can have a more focused scope and still make a decent living off of open source, especially now. But being even a little bit more like off the topic, it doesn't always have to be about greed. You don't have to be like, you know, I wanna get in this because I wanna be completely rich and everything like that. If you're a project admin, you need to care about money, you need to care about business for a lot of other reasons, because money is good for things besides just keeping to yourself. You can buy equipment for your project, you can buy travel to conferences, you can buy conference passes, you can buy hosting, although you shouldn't host it, SourceForge. You can buy other things like swag, dumb stuff like stickers and t-shirts and pizza for your meetings, you know, and things like that. And beer, right? So there are a lot of reasons for open source projects to have money, to understand money, to deal with money. And if you're not interested in money, then you also have to consider someone else might be interested in making money off of your project. And you have to know, do I want them to do that? Do I want to prevent that? Do I want to encourage that? What do I need to do? And that leads me on to this next section. This is sort of the prerequisite soul-searching questions that I think anybody who runs a project should ask in the mindset of business. The first is, should software be free? Right? I'm sure everybody's always thought about this. It's the whole, like, open source versus free software versus proprietary, like it's usually a gradient, but these are kind of the answers I think that apply. Yes, always, no exception, for any reason, software should always be free. That's one potential answer. How many people feel that way?
Yeah, what do you mean by free?
Oh, I'm sorry. Free software, not cost, but free in unencumbered. Free as defined by the Free Software Foundation, meaning that, yes?
No, I'm just like, yeah, I agree.
Okay, so who's A?
Well, we need to see the other options first.
Well, maybe that's part of the game. I don't know. B is, yes, whatever practical, right? So there are some pragmatists who think, like, yeah, you know, it definitely should be free, but sometimes, you know, sometimes I can make, like, piles of fat cash off of it, and then maybe not. Which leads me to C, yes, unless there's a way to make worth my own money restricting the freedom of this software. A lot of people feel this way. Some people feel like software should only be free if it can be useful to somebody else. You know, like, why bother releasing it as open source if no one is going to care? And then some, you know, other people, you know, maybe people in Redmond or whatever think, no, like, why on earth would you want to ever open this software? So I think everybody who wants to think about business and open source should ask themselves this question and figure out where they stand. I think the next question everybody needs to think about is, how would you feel if somebody else profited from your work, right? So, I mean, a lot of people might think, cool, whatever, right? What if you put, like, your weekends and evenings and everything into this thing, and then you find out somebody else that you don't even know is making money off of it? Do you think, cool, right? I mean, how many people would think that's a cool thing, right? Versus how many people would think, that's fine as long as I get credit, you know, as long as the money that they're making and the software that they're making off of it, I get credit for. Some people might think, that's fine as long as they contribute back to my work, right? As long as, you know, they can make money off of it, as long as they're not, you know, stomping my project. Some people might think they can include it in solutions they sell as long as they don't, and then, oh my goodness, the rest of it is totally dead. Okay, well, this, like, was supposed to say they can include it in solutions that they sell, like services and things like that, but I don't want them to sell the actual software, right? So some people might feel that way. And so we want to feel like, you know, I don't want anybody using my work for commercial purposes at all. And I think this is an important question to ask yourself, because if you are a project, an open source project, and you're not necessarily interested in making money, you still need to be knowledgeable about business so that you can make sure other people can do it if it's what you want them to do. The next one I think is kind of important is, why do you create open source? Because I want people to know who I am, maybe? And this, I'm being really crass with this, but building a personal brand is important, right? Legitimately important. It helps people get jobs. It helps a lot of things. Maybe some people do it because their boss, their teacher, or like their mom, or someone told them to do it, right? Like, you know, I'm doing it because somebody asked me to. Some people are doing it specifically to start a business. That happens. Some people find it fun and stimulating, you know, intellectual. And I think that's probably a lot of people in here. And some people because the world needs more free software, right? So what I kind of want you guys to do is keep these in your mind as I go through the next sections, because there's a wide degree of ways of making money, and it all kind of depends on how you feel about these three questions. So now on to the section, making money or how to learn to stop worrying and love the hard cash, right? This first thing I'm going to talk about is business models, because get it, they're all like models, and they're doing business. So I mean, a business model, as we talked about earlier, is just like, you know, figuring out where you get your money from, you know, where you send your products to, who you're selling against, how you make your products better, and that sort of thing. So to go through the different ones of business models, and like I said, this is more focused on project admins, right? Project admins and developers, not so much integrators, trainers, things like that. The first is the open source proprietary hybrid model. And this is where I think you have a core sort of community edition, right? And a lot of the big ones do this. They have the, you know, the MySQL community edition. They have the, most of them do this. And then on top of it, they start adding features like, you know, specialized backup and restore and full text search, because, you know, to actually like search Microsoft Word docs, you need proprietary extensions sometimes, and that has to be an enterprise product. Email integration with like Outlook for the people who might want that. And you call that your professional edition, and you charge money for that. You know, people pay you dollars, and you give them the right to use software. Then they'll add like mobile support, or, you know, specialized reporting, or like a management console, and high availability, whatever. And then they'll call that their enterprise edition, and it costs even more, right? And usually, these are bundled with services, they're bundled with support contracts, etc. What are the pitfalls? Can anybody think of like a pitfall? Yeah.
The management of innovation. Open source community edition, there's really cool stuff going with that, then you're going to have an enormous overhead of what you're about to put into your proprietary version and all that stuff.
Yeah, yeah, the way I phrase it, it might be a bit different, but you have to have core functionality that's good enough that people want to pay for more, right? You know, and you have to make sure that you manage that. So, like, originally, like in SourceForge, when we started this software business, SourceForge Enterprise Edition, it didn't do much more than SourceForge.net. We call it Enterprise Edition, and it failed, right? And that's a lesson learned, right? If you're going to have like an Enterprise Edition, your core needs to be usable, right? You need to have a good core, and then so that's a pitfall. I think also it can be seen as a bit evil in some circles. You know, I mean, like in just some circles. I mean, maybe, but it totally depends on who you are, right? What you care about, who you expect to get help from, right? If you want help from a community, and they're not ideologically aligned with this, then, you know, then you're going to fail. And who you choose to sell to, if your customers aren't ideologically aligned with this, or they don't feel like paying money for software is something that they want. Like, at SourceForge, we don't pay money for software. We just don't do it, you know, ideologically. The other pitfall of this business model is, you know, you need to understand viral licenses. You need to know whether you can actually, you know, sell what you build, right? Like if you're taking a core thing and you're adding proprietary modules on top of it, you need to make sure that that core is not going to have license conflicts with your enterprise edition and things like that. And you also have to make sure that if you're going to actually sell the software and you're bundling it with, like, you know, libjpg or whatever, that you actually have the rights to redistribute that, as an example. Yeah.
Other people will go and build all the enterprise stuff on top of your core anyway.
Yeah.
You don't have to build your somebody else is going to do it and sell it as a service, or with,
That was kind of my point. I think it might be restating what Pierre said, but basically what it becomes about is once you have professional enterprise editions that have extra features, it becomes about limiting what the community can build, because otherwise they'll just build the same thing.
Well, yeah,
so you're now having to actively prevent them from building the same extensions you're already selling.
Or it becomes like an arms race, right? Where you're constantly competing with the community of,
right.
of builders to build something bigger, bigger, better than what they have. And you're using tools like secrecy and manipulation and you know, that sort of stuff to get it done. And a lot of times your community feels co-opted, you know? Well, a lot of these companies that I talk to, these commercial open source companies, I ask them, so how many contributions do you get from your community? Do you have any community committers? And they're like, oh, no, no, no. So it's a marketing strategy, right? Open source sometimes is reduced to a marketing strategy. You know, I make it open source, people feel nice, warm, fuzzy about it, they can download it, it's trialware for them, you know?
A lot of time you might lose the flexibility of the core edition when you go to the commercial and closed projects further online.
Yeah.
Say more about that.
I just feel like comparing, say, Fedora to Red Hat, where you know, Fedora you're pretty much free to do whatever you need to, with Red Hat it is licensed per computer to a degree.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that sort of thing.
Well, whenever you're paying somebody money for software, you're giving up flexibility, right? So these are the companies I could find and I could think of that actually have this business model, you know, this proprietary extension business model. Varying degrees of success, varying degrees of evilness, varying degrees of everything. The next one I want to talk about is the services of support. This has gotten a lot of attention today. But that starts, of course, with the same base, an open source project. And on top of that, you start offering services, customization, you know, I will put your company logo in this so you can use it for your intranet. Installation fees, I mean, when I was doing PS work, we would charge, I don't know, $10K just to go install, you know, just to like make sure the OS was installed correctly and like untar it and set it up and give them a basic walkthrough of the application. That's $10K, you know, and people will pay that. Training also. And then you have, you know, support on the other side, which is a lot of companies now are starting to do indemnity, you know, like license indemnity. If our software causes your network to explode, then you will be compensated 10 times your annual whatever for that software. A lot of people are doing that now. Installation also, support on installation when you have installation questions if you're doing it yourself. Priority patches, you know, our community will give you patches and we'll package them and test them for you before we test them for anybody else, that sort of thing. And basic troubleshooting. So pitfall, the most obvious pitfall, right, with this one is that other people can do that too, right? Like, if you have a product and you're a services-based business, other people can provide services too, right? So a lot of companies get around that by having certified service providers and things like that. So I think the other pitfall is that, yeah, this is a little less evil, right? Because it's a little more pure, software should be free-ish, sort of pure. But the margins are probably a little slimmer, because if you're selling nothing for large amounts of money, that's a great margin. And if you're selling nothing for large amounts of money, it's not such a great margin.
I disagree.
Dave,
okay. I think the margins on support is actually really good, because you're not competing against, I think two things. First of all, you don't need to cut out other people from providing the same support, you just have to be good at your support. It's a big pie out there, it's a huge pie out there.
Yeah.
And ultimately, there's not going to be that many of that, those people focused on the same market you focus on, so just be really good at it and you'll be fine. But the other thing is, I think margin is quite good because you can go into, particularly right now, when a lot of people are being aware but aren't actually commercially paying for a lot of open source software, you know, it's going to be cheaper than the proprietary solution,
mm-hmm.
but it's going to be a bigger margin if you're selling the proprietary solution because there's no licensing costs involved. And so you're actually going to be better off. The client's going to be better off because they're paying less. In the meantime, everyone's happy except the company that's missing out on the licensing fees.
And you're able to give greater support. I think, you know, just to throw it in there, Drupal, you know, yeah, Drupal, but Drupal as a CMS system, you know, Drupal is free. You can download it, you can grab the modules, you can install it. But the average company finds it really hard to go in there, install it, throw the modules in, etc. The Drupal community, so what Drez has done, which is the creator of Drupal, he's then started a spin-off company called Aptana. And what that is that's Drupal with about a basic bunch of modules in it, and it's all packaged and bundled together. So no longer as a company do you have to then go and download Drupal and install modules and try and get them all configured and working.
Mm-hmm.
You can go, you can pay for the Aptana, do this, you know, pay for them to go and come and set up, and just drop down that solution. And I agree with Peter, I think, you know, when you say to a company, look, you're going to be saving $10,000 on, for example, the actual license fees, but you've got $10,000 that you can now spend on support.
Yeah.
And companies are going to do that, and they're more willing to do that because they see great benefit in that.
I was thinking a lot more simple than that. I was just thinking if you build a product and then sell it to 1,000 people, right? Versus like with support, you always or support and services. Whoever's providing that those support and services is getting paid. You can build software and sell it to 10,000 people, but if you sell to 10,000 customers in support, it's going to have a higher cost. I was thinking about it from that perspective. I still think it's a very good margin, and you know, I mean, I think both of these are great business models.
And packaging your support is where you are going to have the benefits of product and support.
Sure. So I think that an alternative to this too, because sometimes people kind of don't really want to, you know, put people on planes and sell support like Open Bravo or Hyperica, those people do. They have heavy sales teams, but there's also a lot of other networks you can sell through, like the Open Logic Expert Community and the SourceForge Marketplace and findopensourcesupport.com, and ways you can like actually just, you know, sell in a smaller way and kind of dip your toe in. The companies that I know that do this are, you know, Open Bravo and Red Hat and Jasper. Alfresco does it to a degree. The next one I want to talk about, and I'm kind of moving fast because I've got about 200 more slides. The next one is dual licensing, and dual licensing is essentially you know, selling the exact same thing to someone with a contract that gives them more rights, right? For example, if you have a GPL piece of software, you can have a special customer that you sell it to that is allowed to now put it in other software and not contribute back. You basically can relicense them with a much more, you know, permissive license. And I think one of the pitfalls there is enforcement, right? Because if you're really just telling someone, oh, no, you can't use it. Wait, I'm giving money? Okay, now you can use it. It's the exact same thing. I mean, how you have a business model that's based on preventing people from doing something, right? As opposed to enabling them to be able to do something. Then the other pitfall is that you're not really selling anything at all, necessarily, except licensing. So customers eventually are going to get smart to that and realize they're not really buying anything at all. They're just buying licensing. So I think that closes the business model section. There's also some fundraising things that I think are potential ways to create revenue in an open source project. The first of that's merchandising. For example, the Audacity store, they sell clothing, accessories, they sell audio interfaces that they know work with Audacity. The Mozilla store sells a bunch of stuff, stickers and, you know, stuffed foxes and things like that. Is that a fox? Yeah, it's a fox. you know, there's also the Debian store that sells mouse pads and coffee mugs and things like that. And I don't have any numbers on whether this is a tiny business or not, but people are doing it, and I'm assuming it works okay. You can also get into the business of making books, you know, like the GIMP book or the Inkscape book or whatever. For those of you who can't read it, this says, the acid is kicking in. One of the pitfalls of this is that, you know, like, you have to manufacture and ship this stuff, and there are logistics, and, you know, there's that sort of thing. Another business model, and this is the one that I personally probably know most about because SourceForge is an advertising company, but it's advertising. Who can see the ads on this page? They're kind of obvious, not as obvious as they could be, but they're right there. And similarly on MediaCoder, a little more obvious, you know, they're right there. And there's a couple different ways you can slice advertising. The first is on a cost per impression basis. In this, for example, let's say N is your number of pages, and let's say CPM is your cost per 1,000 impressions. M is 1,000 because of the Roman numeral, you know, not M for million. I always got that wrong for like years, and people told me, it's like, no, you're an idiot. So if N divided by 1,000 times CPM is how much money you make, right? So if you got 1,000,000 hits, and you're getting a $3 CPM, then you're making $3,000, right? There's another way to sell this, it's cost per click. N could be your number of pages, CTR is the percentage of people that actually click on stuff, DPC is like dollars per click, although no one calls it DPC, I couldn't figure out what else to call it. So N times CTR times DPC is your money, right? Which means if you have 1,000,000 hits and 0.3% of the people click, which is kind of like, that's kind of low, but it's realistic, and you have a CPM or a dollar per click of $1 roughly, you can make that same $3,000. And we have what's called an effective CPM. So $3,000 for 1,000,000 impressions is an effective CPM of $3. Right. So if you take that with these numbers, like, so you're looking at basically 1,000,000 hits using these fake BS numbers is like $3,000. These numbers are realistic. They're not accurate, but they're realistic. So let's look at, for example, Emule. This past week has had 8 million page views. Right. So that's $24,000 a week they could be pulling in just with advertising. Right. And they're like the outlier, as you can see. Right. But people like, for example, Gallery, they're at the very bottom, you know, they got like a 500,000 a week, that's 2 million a month, that's $6,000 a month, right? That's not like wild money, but it's enough to, you know, it's enough to pay for some pizza and some airplane tickets and some conference passes, you know, for your community. So the pitfall is that you need like a lot of traffic to make it work. You know, you need to actually have millions and millions of people coming to your project website to leverage them in this way. The second is that, and we know this more than anybody else, is your users might find it like really, really irritating that people are being shown ads on an open source website. It's ideologically inconsistent with a lot of your audience. So think about that. There's also this whole arms race between your scammers and your competition. For example, what's a good example of this? Audacity, right? Someone went out and registered getaudacity.com, for example, and then they charge you $50 and then they send you the SourceForge download page. It's a total scam. And then they buy AdWords and they show advertising on SourceForge on the Audacity page, right? So they're totally trying to scam people. And it's an arms race. They come to us and they say, we need you to block these people because they're dicks, and we block them, and then they go register a new domain and they start over, and it's an arms race, right?
It's very popular with OpenOffice, apparently. A lot of places are being sold OpenOffice for money.
Yeah. I mean, we've seen people sell, you know, we've seen people sell Inkscape on eBay, right? And the thing is, if you're selling a CD of Inkscape, that's fine. I mean, technically, there's nothing in the license that prevents you from selling it, I don't think, but, like, there's people, they're attempting to defraud people, right? The other one is donations, grants, and memberships, and things like that. Some people take the foundation approach, you know, like Linux Foundation, the Mambo Foundation, that sort of thing. Some people won't use the SourceForge donation system, you know, to get a little bit of extra cash. A lot of people end up using this, and geez, I need to really hurry up. But the main pitfall to all of this money stuff is that you need to be able to actually cope with money. You need to be able to officially be able to accept money. You need to be able to have governance to decide how to distribute it to your members. You need to have an agreement amongst your community of how this money is going to be spent. If you are a business, then of course you have to have all this stuff. But if you're just a project looking to dabble your foot in the business world a little bit, you know, you might overlook that. So the next section, and this is the last section, but it's a long one, I think. Businessy things that also have an uncanny application in open source. So things you understand if you're in business that also apply to open source communities. And the first is the sales funnel, right? Anybody familiar with the sales funnel, by the way? Yeah, okay. So if these people, like this is, they're gonna get narrower. If these people are the people who might actually buy your stuff someday, then maybe these people are willing to talk to you on the phone, right? If they're willing to talk to you on the phone, then these are the people where the conversation goes good and you think, hey, maybe I can actually sell them something. And then after more talking, that many people, you still think you can help. That many people want to buy it, right? That many people can agree with you on how much it costs, and these people will actually pay, right? So that's the sales funnel. And people who understand sales know that you have to manage all the different barriers of that funnel. You know, if people are willing to talk to you because you have good brand recognition, but they're not willing to buy what you're selling, maybe you have product problems. If they're willing to buy what you sell, but you know they can't agree on the specifics of the functionality, maybe you have compatibility problems. You know, and people work on eliminating that barrier from a product perspective to make the sales funnel a little more smooth. The open source funnel is very oddly similar. If these many people are looking for a solution to their problem, then those people can find your project, right? When they search on Google, they can find your project. This many people choose to download your project. This many people can figure out how to install your project, and depending on your project, that might be a lot smaller or a lot bigger, right? Some things it's like you drag it over and it's done, or you run apt-get on it and you skip all four bars. This many people actually have installed it and have decided that they want to use it and will actually use it instead of letting it sit on their machines and not use it. This many people will participate in like really, really small ways, like clicking OK when it asks you to file a crash report, or going to a mailing list and saying, you know, it broke on my computer, I'm running some wacky version of Sonos and it doesn't work. These many people might actually generate new value to your project. They might write how-tos, they might write plugins or extensions or something like that. This many people will take the time to understand how your project works and what it does, and then these people will actually submit patches, and then these people will actually try to become a committer, right? So if you're looking to get your project off the ground and get it built, I think a lot of it starts with consumption, but it's a very similar funnel and it's a very similar approach you take to it. And what are the different barriers in each of these steps that I can eliminate to make more people hit the bottom of the funnel? So different projects have different widths at the top, right? So the first thing is, how wide is the top of your funnel, right? Everybody needs an office suite. A lot of people need a peer-to-peer thing. It's kind of wide. Everybody wants free shit. Everybody takes pictures and wants to put it on their website, right? You know, everybody wants to manipulate them, you know. So it's getting narrower and narrower. Some people have audio they want to edit. Some people are running a database and don't want a shell in to manage it, right? So, you know, but it's getting smaller and smaller. You know, some people run data centers, but not as many as the people who need an office suite. So it's getting smaller and smaller and smaller. You know, some people compile code, and then my dumb project that I haven't touched in 10 years, no one cares about. So if you graph it on impact versus audience, mine's in the far, far left. But both of these things contribute to who enters your funnel. Then you have to think about all the different barriers in your funnel. Like, first off, is it hard to find? If you type in open source audio software, do you find your project in Google, right? Think about SEO, think about how people are finding your project. Once they find it, like, is it easy to download? One of the gallery folks told me that they did a heat map on their website, and they found that, like, everybody was trying to click the download button, and most people weren't finding it. So they made their download button, like, freaking huge, like, this big, and then, like, that people started downloading more. It's crazy. I mean, how long do you take to read a web page when you first start trying to download something? Like a second, second and a half? Firefox.com, click, oh, there it is, kaboom, click on download, right? Make it easy. These people do the same thing. The Audacity people do the same thing. Is it easy to install, right? You know, like, is it something you can install with AppKit if you're a Linux app? You know, are you in all the right distros? Are you putting barriers in front of installation? You know, if you're on a Mac, you know, Firefox is great, you drag it, right? Some people make it harder than that, though. You know, use install shields and things like that. And this is like a great example. I did a blog post about this a while ago. I think that everybody, you know, who runs an open source project is thinking, how can I drive more participation, that sort of thing. These guys have done something really smart, because some people are willing to put time into understanding your code. You know, some people will put time into understanding all this. Most people won't. Most people will, when they see this, they'll go, yeah, I'll submit the crash report. And that is like the limit of their participation, you know? But it's still valuable, you know? It's still something you want to capture. So do you make it easy for people to get involved with your application? Do you make it easy for people to say, yeah, this worked on my platform, you know? Also, you know, can people understand your code, what you're doing? You know, have you made code that's easy to understand? All these are barriers that keep people from hitting the bottom of your funnel. And it's the same kind of approaches, it's the same thought process you need to take when you're doing sales. So I think it's kind of uncanny how that matches across. It's all about who your audience is and what prevents them from doing what you want to do at each stage of the funnel. The next thing I want to talk about that's similar in open source and business is branding. And a lot of people are thinking, like, branding is totally evil, it's for evil corporations. And yeah, there's tons of, like, evil corporations that brand. I'm not saying all these corporations are evil, but people see branding and they think, ooh, yeah, somebody's trying to manipulate me. And I think that's kind of true. You know, branding is developing and aligning expectations to create the impression that a brand has certain qualities that make it special, right? So you're trying to convince somebody that you're special. That's what branding essentially is. So, for example, do you guys have generic soda in Australia? Like, name brand soda and then, like, the cheap generic soda? I don't know. I've never been here before. Okay, well, usually, like, in the United States, this stuff costs about 55 cents a liter, right?
A liter?
Yeah,
it's cheap. And then Coke costs $1.42 a liter, right? And it's basically the same stuff. I mean, you drink it, you're like, oh, that's Coke. This is that's fuzzy too, but it still gets me high and, you know, quenches my thirst. So it's the same stuff, and people are paying almost three times as much for it. And why? Why are they doing that? Is it really the flavor, or is it the brand? You know. So branding inspires confidence in people, and that's why businesses do it. For example, looking at this logo, what's your first thought? What do you think this what do you think about this company? Where have you heard of this company? They're so green, exactly. Right? They used to have this stodgy, like, you know, oil company, like, evil shithead, like, logo, and now they're this green company with, like, this, like, sparkly stars and suns and stuff.
Yeah.
And
the first thing I think is they're trying to compensate for all the people they killed.
Well, there you go.
It's really hard to compensate.
It's a flower. They're trying to redo the environment.
There you go. But you know what? It seems kind of powerful, because I see this and I'm like, aw, those guys. You know, like, and I'm like, wait a second, what am I saying? Those guys are evil.
So,
it's the second time they've done it, though, right? And the first time, you know, I read in this report that, you know, the first time they revamped their logo and appearance was to improve their environmental image, because their head of public relations said BP's image is a major commercial and political asset, and like any asset needs to be looked over, right? These guys spent a lot of money on their brand completely without touching the value of their company, just talking about how great they are, and it seems to have some level of success, because, you know, I would bet who in here's first thought is not, oh wow, what a bunch of evil jerks when you see the logo. I don't think that, you know, I mean, let's admit it, right? It kind of works. Also, brand loyalty. People get crazy about their brands. I'd show you. I have a Linux tattoo right here, the penguin. I go crazy over brands too. Even though I use a Mac, I'm totally the hypocritic guy. But people that have brand loyalty think, well, everything that this company makes must be that good. You know, I got to admit, I'm like the total conflict of everything, because I have a Mac and I like Apple stuff, but I really believe in open source and all this stuff. But I have brand loyalty to Mac. I generally think a lot of things that they make solve my problems, right? And so, you know, the brand means something to me. So the question then is, what does that have to do with open source? You know, like, we don't need to convince people that they need to spend more money on our stuff. We're not going to say, spend more on my open source thing because it's got the brand, right? We don't need to be seen as nice people when we're doing evil stuff, because we're generally not, right? And we don't need to get people necessarily addicted, yet you see a lot of really strong branding in open source. And I think the reason is pretty simple. I think people are looking for kind of team colors. They're looking for, oh yeah, you know, my community wants to collect around this, and so my community's gonna wear a Firefox shirt, and they're gonna have to put Firefox stickers on, and I think that branding gives something people this jagged binding surface to collect on. I think also because it helps people know who you are, specifically your consumers, because it helps you get more users, I think. People, yeah, so Fossology's got branding. You know, it helps you get more users because people can visually identify you. And I think the most important thing is it helps you get taken seriously by consumers who are used to seeing branding, right? If you have a consumer who has not seen open source much at all, and you know, they get to your page and it's this barren, you know, wasteland visually, and then they get to another page which is for this pay software, and they'll think, wow, you know, like, their brand is well thought out, and I think that the user experience is probably gonna be better because of that, right? So I think branding does actually matter. And a quote from Starbucks, probably one of the most egregious branders ever, said that the branding for them is affirmation that the cup of coffee you're drinking really matters. Which is like a great quote from that guy. But really it's that, you know, it's like, if you have a core foundation of technology, there is a certain amount of, you know, making your consumers feel comfortable with dealing with you that has to do with branding, and it's kind of become a cultural thing. So the next thing that I think is kind of similar between business and open source is that you have to kind of spread the word, and business relies on press releases, you know, and the subsequent news cycles, you know, you put out a press release and some you know, sleepy journalist picks it up and gives you an interview and asks you just softball questions, and then you end up on Matt Acey's blog, right? Well, not if you're not business. Anyway, they also do traditional print, television, internet advertising, and thank goodness they do, because I couldn't have paid for my airplane flight otherwise. People want to do standard internet advertising and just blast the word out there, and word of mouth and things like that. So the question, and I'll wrap up soon, I promise, is what can open source learn from the traditional promotion? I think that a lot of other people are covering the same thing, but the first thing is you need to express your value very, very clearly to people when you're telling them your story, when you're talking to press, when you're talking to, you know, if you ever choose to do advertising or anything like that. You need to make sure that, like Azure's here, find, download, and play high quality and HD videos. Very clear story, right? Gallery, very clear. Photo album organizer, very clear value. But I think importantly, you need to have a good story, because reporters want to look smart and they want to write something interesting. And the story of, hey, we're a bunch of smart guys and we made this really cool tech, doesn't really work. You have to say why your tech matters and what the value is for your tech and things like that. So also, open source has got some specific opportunities where you can do Google Alerts and blogging and things like that that don't really exist in the business world. There's lots of social networking aspects you can do. The other thing I'll leave you with is, I think it's important, if you're an open source project and you're trying to spread the word, to connect to your related communities. Go to the GNOME project listing, your GNOME project. List yourself there. That's something, that's an advantage open source sort of news and sort of spreading the word in open source has an advantage over business, is that you can actually connect to other communities with Powered By and things like that. Use social media and things like that actually work pretty well too in open source, better than I think they work in most business. And that's actually it. That's it. Go. Are you totally out of time?
No, you got a couple minutes.
Oh, I do?
Yeah.
Well, why did I gloss over all that last stuff? All right, any questions? I feel like I've got like 40 minutes. What's up?
Getting back to your first session when you're discussing advertising.
Yeah.
In terms of advertising revenue, what do you think the impact will be of stuff like Adblock Plus and other methods to remove that entire different user experience?
Well, from a personal perspective, I'm not quite as worried about it. I think that's because we do a lot of our stuff CPM. No, I'm just kidding. We actually don't talk a lot about that. You'd be surprised, because a lot of people we talk to at SourceForge are like, you know, oh wow, what do you think about all the ad blocking? Isn't that ruining your business? And we don't really talk about it. It doesn't have that much of an effect on us, which is really surprising and shocking. And I think maybe the reason is because the kinds of people that our advertisers are trying to reach are not the people who are developing the software, it's the people who are downloading the software. It's a bunch of like, you know, IT directors and CTOs and things like that, and people who don't have ad block on. Maybe part of that also is that if you look at the SourceForge traffic, I mean, we do anywhere between 25 and 30 million unique visitors a month, which is like mind-bogglingly huge, and I don't even know how it got that big, but like, that's a lot. And of that, how many are developers who are gonna run ad block out of 30 million, right? So you cast your net wide enough, that becomes statistical noise. You know, you're not gonna have 30 million people putting ad block on their system every month coming to SourceForge necessarily. I mean, you might, it might become more of a problem, but I think it gets lost in the noise of the traffic.
Actually, thank you. I've done some stuff for an emulation project. It turns out PayPal doesn't allow emulation projects to use their services.
Emulation projects?
Yeah.
Like, what emulation in what
sense? Gaming emulations, in this sense.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so, you know, they sent us some nice notes to that. I know you're not allowed to use some SourceForge work. As far as I can tell, the only people that actually managed to get PayPal to ever make an exemption to any of their policies ever.
Oh, didn't we?
Yeah.
Cool.
Do you think that as much is the model of software as a service very useful, where your software, if you let people download it, it's open source, but you also host it? I mean, I'm thinking of things like maybe LiveJournal, where there's a social or community aspect, and therefore people may prefer to join the one that you're hosting kind of definitively rather than download it and just use it by themselves.
Yeah, I think so. And now that I think of it, that's a big thing missing from the business model one. I mean, it kind of fits into service, but not really. SaaS is a whole new business model. So next time I give this talk, I'll put a section in for that, definitely. Because I think that's definitely that makes a lot of sense. Cool. Thank you.